Sorry I'm a little bit late, but I had an urgent matter that I had to take care of. Some business that we had to take care of. I apologize for you. But I welcome you all here, and I thank you all for coming down. It's a little series, two-week series that we had during the month of March to have to let people know who the Hibernians are, what we do. And John, who's a member of us, of our organization, has agreed to come down and do a little talk on the Irish immigration, the famine, and he's going to do some stuff on the wreck of the brig St. John's. I get the brig in there. You like that, don't you? So John has done a lot of work. He does little lectures on astronomy, history, and
weather, fires.
And I was here a couple of weeks ago when he did the Great Fires of Watertown. It was a great presentation. So we're looking forward to a good one tonight. Again, thank you all for coming in. Here's John.
Thank you. Thank you, Leo. A couple things about Leo. First of all, a round of applause for him because he's a wonderful president of the Hibernians. Second of all, he looks great. Okay, Jen, thank you very much. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As Leo mentioned, my name's John Horrigan. I'm battling through some severe bronchitis. It's been 2 weeks now, and I've never been hit like this before. So we're going to fight through it together, but it's a pleasure to be here tonight. You're going to see a lot of slides tonight with a text narrative. If you can't read it, don't worry. I'll bellow it out. The great bloviator up here, okay? As Leo mentioned, my expertise is in American urban fires from the 17th through the 19th centuries and great fires of Western civilization, historical astronomy, and historical weather. I think I've got my arms around every single major storm to hit America since the 1600s. And then I also research historical disasters. I call myself an old New England folklorist. There are no letters that precede or follow my name. Couple of things. One of my missions is the new popular public history, to bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history. If it were not for contemporary genealogy, then America would have lost her grasp of her grand heritage altogether. It's amazing that I can't get anybody under 40 to attend my lectures. I also belong to the Historical Society of Watertown. Joyce Kelly is here representing them. Please, Hibernians, stop by the Fowl House. It's the nexus of liberty. Those rabble-rousers that got liberty going here in the American Revolution, they gathered right down the street. Please stop by sometime this summer. It's a beautiful place. They've renovated it, okay? And if I break out into a hockey voice, I've been with the Boston Bruins alumni as their celebrity hockey announcer for 17 years, and I'm also the New England Patriots basketball announcer. So, cell phones off, please. Usually when I say that, mine rings. Questions at the end of the lecture. Also, my axiom is there's always someone in attendance who knows more about the subject than I do, and of course someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. So I ask that you hold your questions until the end of the lecture. Fire exits, you know how to get out here. Go out here, take a left, get away from the building. Restrooms, left, right, out here. If you want to get a hold of me, you can log on to johnhorrigan.com or send me an email at johnhorrigan@hotmail.com. Finally, at the Hibernian Hall, I have the New England History Festival. I call it Historapalooza or Farm Aid for Reenactors, where we get to all sorts of different actors from different periods in American history, and they perform. It's at the Hibernian Hall, November 14th. My brothers and sisters from the AOH, you're all welcome. So we're going to talk about the wreck of the St. John. We're going to go to 1849. What's going on in America here and what's going on in Ireland over there? A scarcity of taties. The famine queen. The dream. The Hannah. The storm. The voyage. The observer. And time permitting, great shipwrecks of the South Shore. So we have to travel back to 1849 tonight. And we can either get on board H.G. Wells' time machine, or you can get in the back seat with this guy. And I'll tell you what, I ain't riding with that guy. Time machine reminders, no smoking, shoes off please, pass through the detector one at a time before boarding, hands inside the vehicle, seatbelts fastened, nominal fee of $5 to rent a pillow, snacks are no longer complimentary, there are numerous hidden surcharges, and I've just learned that our trip tonight has been delayed by 2 hours. Bear with me, here we go. Okay, here we go. Going back in time. BCE. 13th century, the Crusades. Columbus. Shakespeare. Pilgrims. Washington, Trail of Tears, Alamo, which was a few years before the St. John, and we're here, it's the year 1849. On February 28th of 1849, regular steamboat service from the east to the west begins from the west coast of the United States with the arrival of the SS California in San Francisco Bay. The California leaves New York Harbor on October 6, 1848, rounds Cape Horn at the tip of South America, and arrives in San Francisco, California after a four-month, 21-day journey. On March 3rd of 1849, the Department of Interior established and passed the Gold Coinage Act. So who was the second 12th president of the United States? The second 12th president of the United States. Anybody?
Zachary Harrison?
Close. You got the first part right. Zachary Taylor. And if you notice, I said the second 12th president. Well, what's up with that? Zachary Taylor refused to be sworn in as president on the Sabbath, Sunday, March 4th, 1849. After hearing this, Taylor's vice president-elect, Millard Fillmore, decided to take spirits in a pre-inaugural celebration. This is important. So who was the first 12th president of the United States? This guy. And I'll give you a hint. It wasn't VP-elect Millard Fillmore, as he had been overserved that day. Urban legend holds that David Rice Acheson, president pro tempore of the United States Senate, was the first 12th president du jour for a single day sworn in on Sunday, March 4th, 1849. Here's a daguerreotype taken by Matthew Brady in 1849, one of the earliest photographs ever taken of President Taylor and his cabinet. President Taylor is standing in the middle. Zachary Taylor's death is not well understood. On July 4th, 1850, Taylor consumed a snack of milk and cherries at an Independence Day celebration. 5 days later, he died of gastroenteritis on July 9th, 1850. In the late 1980s, an author theorized that Taylor was murdered by poison and was able to convince Taylor's closest living relative, as well as the Jefferson County, Kentucky coroner, to order an exhumation. On June 17, 1991, Taylor's remains were exhumed from the vault at the Zachary Taylor National Cemetery in Louisville, Kentucky. Radiological studies were conducted of the remains. The samples were sent to Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where neutron activation analysis reveals traces of arsenic at levels several hundred times less than necessary for poisoning to have occurred. Zachary Taylor was not poisoned. Other things going on in 1849. April 6th, Windsor, Ontario catches fire, only to be saved by the Detroit Fire Brigade. They regale them with the finest things in the city, and I'll leave that to your imagination. April 21st, 96 inmates of the overcrowded Ballin Robe Union Workhouse die over the course of the preceding week from illness and other famine-related conditions, a record high. The dead were buried in unmarked, shallow graves. May 3rd, a break in the Mississippi River levee at Sauvé's Crevasse floods much of New Orleans, Louisiana. May 11th, Minnesota becomes a state. May 13th, the Great Fire of Watertown, New York begins in a stagecoach shed and burns down the entire business district. May 17th, the St. Louis fire starts when a steamboat catches fire and nearly burns down the entire city. $5 million damage, that's $1,849, and 23 steamboats are lost. May 25th at 10 p.m., the steamer Empire and schooner Noah Brown collide on the Hudson River at Newburgh and over 100 drown. June 1st, 130,000 Russian troops pour into Hungary. July 3rd, French troops occupy Rome. Roman Republic surrenders. July 6th, the Danish Army beats the Prussian Army at Jutland. September 1st, the first segment of the Pennsylvania Railroad from Lewiston, Pennsylvania to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania opens for service. So we're just getting the railroad here. September 25th, Johann Strauss, Sr., Austrian composer, dies. October 7th, Edgar Allan Poe dies. October 17th, Frédéric Chopin, Polish-French musician and composer, dies. November 16th, a Russian court sentences Fyodor Dostoevsky to death for anti-government activities linked to a radical intellectual group, but his execution is canceled at the last minute. Other things of 1849, some inventions from that year, the conical bullet, the safety pin, chewing gum, and absolute zero is discovered by Lord Kelvin. Telegraph is in use in limited capacity. Parts of Boston, as are some major coastal towns, are strung for limited service. It's only 5 years since Samuel Morse sent the message, "What hath God wrought?" So we have basic telegraph service in Massachusetts at that time and basic rail service. And what else is going on in 1849? The California Gold Rush. James Marshall finds gold flakes at John Sutter's Mill on January 24th, 1848. And what's going on in Ireland? Famine. Now, this particular map shows you the percent of the population. The red indicates what percent of the population is in the lowest class housing. And what I mean by that is a lean-to, boards leaning together, some sort of tarpaulin, makeshift tarpaulin. If you were living in a cottage during those years, you were living the high life. And then the percent literate. So if you notice on this particular graph, the people in Dublin, to the far east, 9% are in lowest class housing, and over half can read. So this directly correlates to the famine in terms of how well you are educated and how well you are housed. And you can just look at some of the counties. Kildare, 27% were living in lowest class housing, 35% were literate. Wicklow, to the south of Dublin, 28% were lowest class housing, 37% were literate. And then as you go now, let's move west. Let's start with Mayo, County Mayo. 60% are in the lowest class housing. Only 13% can read. Okay, Galway, same thing, to the southeast of Mayo. Half the people are in low-class housing. Only 15% can read. Clare, to the southwest of Galway. Half the people are in low-class housing. 25% can read. Kerry, to the southwest of Clare. 60% are in low-class housing. Only a quarter can read. So you can see that the famine years ravished to the west of Ireland. In 1704, the penal codes were enacted by England. Catholics could not buy land. Catholics could not inherit land from Protestants. Catholic fathers had to bequeath land equally to sons unless one was a Protestant, and then he inherited it all. Catholics could not lease land for more than 31 years. They had to take the oath to England. The king was their spiritual leader. No mass. They had to pay a tithe to support Protestant clergy. There was one priest to a parish. There was an exile of Catholic bishops. No formal education was allowed. They couldn't go to Trinity College. They were banned from professions. No intermarriage. They had no vote in parliamentary elections. They had no political or military offices. They could not have guns or weapons. And they could have no horse worth more than 5 pounds. Now, if we take that graph that I showed you a couple of slides ago and put it up against the famine, the poor people, the illiterate people, get hammered by the famine. To the west, 100% decimation, 100%, 60% in the red, 45% in the yellow. So for all intent and purpose, Ireland proper is absolutely decimated by the famine from 1845 through 1849. The Great Famine, and jump in if I mispronounce these, okay? Here we go. The Great Hunger, Angorta Mor, Androchal. Okay. The product of the Irish potato famine was the Irish diaspora. The Irish diaspora consists of Irish emigrants and their descendants in countries such as Great Britain, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Argentina, Mexico, and states of the Caribbean and continental Europe. Maximally interpreted, it contains over 80 million people, which is over 14 times the population of the island of Ireland itself, which in 2007 had 6.11 million people. The blight, Phytophthora infestans. I always have to wipe my mouth when I say that. You can see it's devastating. The potato in the middle. This was their staple cloth. Where did it come from? It came from Bolivia and Peru in the Lake Titicaca region, which was on the Peruvian and Bolivian border. That's where they think it emanated and came to Ireland on board a ship. Autumn, 1845, a fungus-based potato disease reaches Ireland from South America. Nearly half of the Irish population was entirely reliant upon the potato. Nearly half the Irish population was reliant upon the potato. The blight spread during the wet spring and summer of 1846, causing an almost total failure of that year's crop. In 1847, many people had of necessity eaten their seed potatoes, and the overall crop was again disastrously low. So when you eat your seed potatoes, you're all done with farming. In 1848, it saw yet another crop failure. In 1849 and 1850, the blight was less severe. When the potato crop failed again in 1849, famine was accompanied by cholera outbreaks. This deadly cholera epidemic kills one of Ireland's greatest poets, James Clarence Mangan. During the time of the famine, 1845 to 1851, it's estimated that over 1 million people died of starvation and the diseases that followed. Nearly 2 million emigrated, mostly to Canada, the United States, Australia, and England. The catastrophe was almost entirely borne by the laborer and small farmers who, because of their circumstances under the heels of the British landlords, had nothing but the meager potato crop that they had planted to sustain life. Everything else they earned went to rent and the barest necessities. During the height of the genocide, only one crop had failed and many were unaffected. Livestock thrived in Ireland. Relief efforts were stymied by the British government at every level. British landowners would rather see cattle and sheep on the land than Irish peasantry, i.e. Catholics, and made sure it happened through cold strategy while staying within the tenancy laws. They could make much more money with cattle grazing than having those Catholics there planting potatoes. During the crisis, as hundreds of thousands of Irish people were dying of starvation and its effects, crops and livestock were actually exported out of Ireland to England. Foreign relief from the United States and elsewhere was routed through English ports where taxes were extracted and precious time was wasted before they could reach Ireland. Humanitarian, life-sustaining aid that civilized societies normally provide to those in need was denied by the British to the Irish on the grounds that such relief would spoil them in the future. Landlords wasted no time in legally evicting Irish tenants from their homes, even though there was no possibility to make rent payments. Eviction was likely to mean certain death with absolutely nowhere to go except to live in ditches known as scalpines. Emigration was only an option for the lucky few and prone to end in death of either typhus or cholera or as human cargo in steerage on the ghastly coffin ships or heretofore known as the famine ships. The scale of suffering endured by the Irish during the famine is almost unimaginable. The following account of a visit to Skibbereen in County Cork was written by Nicholas Cummins, a British magistrate, on Christmas Eve, 1846. I'm going to do the best, and I apologize for the accent up front. On reaching the spot, I was surprised to find the wretched hamlet apparently deserted. I entered some of the hovels to ascertain the cause, and the scenes which presented themselves were such as no tongue or pen can convey the slightest idea of.
in the first, six famished and ghastly skeletons, to all appearances dead, were huddled in a corner on some filthy straw, their sole covering which seemed a ragged horse cloth, their wretched legs hanging about, naked above the knees. I approached with horror, and found by a low moaning they were alive. They were in fever, four children, a woman, and what had once been a man. Suffice it to say that in a few minutes I was surrounded by at least 200 such phantoms, such frightful spectres as no words can describe, either from famine or fever. The demonic yells are still ringing in my ears, and their horrible images are fixed in my brain. The same morning, the police opened a house on the adjoining lands, and two corpses were found lying upon the mud floor, having been devoured by rats. A mother, herself in fever, was seen the same day to drag the corpse of her child, a girl about 12, perfectly naked, and leave it half covered with stones. In another house, with 500 yards of the Calvary station at Skibbereen, the dispensary doctor found seven wretches lying unable to move under the same cloak. One had been dead many hours, but the others were unable to move either themselves or the corpse. People were forced out of their houses, and this is the frigid, damp, cold Irish air. Just some depictions here of a scalpeen, a ditch. This guy here, he's living the high life with a hay bale. There were attempts to halt the evictions, but always, the riots were always brutally suppressed. Some depictions there. They're trying to hold them back, upper left-hand corner. During the years of the famine, a decline in the population of Ireland set in, one which was continued almost to the present. In 1841, the population was 8.2 million. Merely 10 years later, it had declined by 2 million to 6.2 million. In 1976, the population of Ireland was 4.7 million. And then we got this one, the famine queen. Queen Victoria, born 1819, died 1901. She reigned way too long. She reigned from 1837 until 1901. 64 years. The Empress of India. The Victorian era. Under her rule, the British people enjoyed a long period of prosperity as profits were gleaned from the expanding British Empire overseas. Domestically, there are improvements in industry, architecture, literature, art, and a large educated middle class developed. The Pax Britannica, and this is a piece of Britain. This is, of course, if you ignore the brutal crushing of India. Well, what'd she do? She turned a blind eye to the crisis in Ireland. Queen Victoria contributed only £5,000 to the famine relief effort. That's £70,000 by today's standards. Lord John Russell, depicted here as a potato, and his ministry committed democide, a deliberate policy of negligence rather than of a planned killing. So the Irish population, as I mentioned, in 1841 was 8.2 million. The Irish famine was proportionally more destructive of human life than the famines of modern times. It killed an eighth of the Irish population. The calamity was essentially man-made, a poison concoction of blind politics, scientific ignorance, rural suppression, and enforced poverty, according to Joe Judge in 1981. The famine became a major platform for emigrant anger as the political liberties and freedom of opportunity that they encountered in America confirmed to them the potential of an independent Ireland, and it made them more passionate than their brethren at home. In the late 19th century and throughout the 20th century, English writers drove Irish revisionism in literature and art to undermine the basis of Irish nationalism so as to leave Ireland without heroes or historical memory. It also played down the responsibility of the English government for exacerbating the famine.
Only recently, in 1998, did British Prime Minister Tony Blair accept full responsibility for the actions and inactions of the British government and offer a sincere apology. Sorry if I get angry here. You know, one thing when we talk about the famine, they always forget about the poor brothers and sisters of Scotland. And I'm going to tell you about the forgotten Highland potato famine. The Scottish Highlands suffered a potato famine during the same period as the Irish famine, as their potato crops were also blighted by a fungal disease. Oatmeal was distributed in daily rations, 24 ounces per man, 12 ounces per woman, and 8 ounces per child. A good meal, huh? Jeez. Crofters were not given these rations. They were expected to work for them 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. Destitution roads were built through the craggy Scottish hills to expedite the eviction of peasants. They were put to work to build the own roads for them to walk out on. Most landlords simply wanted the extermination of the population, although some landlords actually paid for their passage to Nova Scotia and Canada. In Wick, Cromarty, and in Invergordon, grain was being exported from local harbors. All right. The Fields of Athenry, written by Pete St. John and first recorded by Irish ballad singer Danny Doyle in the 1970s, it was popularized by the Boston-based rock band Dropkick Murphys in 2003 on their album Blackout. My brother Jeff, as a side note, wrote that song Tessie, that Red Sox anthem. And there's a picture of yours truly up there with the Bruins defenseman Andrew Ferentz and Ken Casey of the Dropkick Murphys. They have a bar called McGreevy's in Boston if you ever get a chance to stop in. It's a song about Michael being deported to Botany Bay, and I'm going to play it to you right now, okay? It starts out, but it's just basically it's the Dropkicks take an old Irish anthem and they put it to. I'll just play a little. This group has done more to bring back an awareness of Irish heritage in the 21st century than any other group. I mean, you had the Chieftains in the 80s and 90s who are super group, but the Dropkicks, and there are our guys, they're from Boston. Okay. Anyways, it's on the album Blackout. So Trevelyan. You know, if you're going to point to one person, a culprit for the famine, I still just, my angst, you saw me vent on Queen Victoria, but this guy too. Trevelyan, Charles Edward Trevelyan, a senior British civil servant in the administration of the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in Dublin Castle, is one of the primary culprits of inaction, as his reports to London understated the severity of the famine and insisted problems would arise if the starving were assisted in any manner. If you give them food, they're going to depend on that. Trevelyan's corn that you heard mentioned in the Dropkick song may not have meant Irish wheat, but likely was a reference to the relief maize that was being imported from America and subsequently being siphoned off from warehouses and subsequently exported. As this corn was meant for seed and not for milling, it was used mostly in gruel. A lot of the grain rotted on docks and piles that was exposed to the elements as they were waylaid by bureaucracy. In 1985, Irish rocker Bob Geldof and founder of the Mammoth Benefit Concert Live Aid announced that the people of Ireland had given more to this fundraising effort per head of population than any other nation on earth. They never forgot. U2, the Cranberries, Van Morrison, Sinead O'Connor, and the Chieftains are also major Irish entertainers who perform for charitable causes. Irish relief charities, Goal, Concern, Trocare and Gorda play a major role in helping famine victims in Africa. They never forgot. Downtown Boston, the Famine Memorial, downtown crossing between Washington and School Street. I always move when I walk by that. So now, what do they got to do? They got to leave. We got to leave while we can. There's a new beginning. There's talk of a better place. I want to talk about the Hannah, which also suffered a fate similar to the St. John. This is Claude Joseph Vernet's The Shipwreck, painted in 1772. The hull was laid in Maryport, Ireland, of the Hannah, and it left Newry on April 3, 1849, bound for Quebec. The captain was Curry Shaw, displacing 150 to 200 tons. There were 200 Irish immigrants on board, along with 12 seamen. It struck an iceberg at 4 a.m. on April 29, 1849, in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. First and second officer put the lifeboat out and left everyone else on deck. How do you like that? Jump in it, and they split. Many were in their nightclothes, leapt into the ice floes, and slid into the icy waters. The bark Nicaragua saw the distress flag a little after 5 p.m. They saw over 50 men, women, and children freezing to death on one large iceberg. Some had been crushed to death between the massive ice chunks. No pen, Captain Marshall observes, can describe the pitiable situation of the poor creatures. They were all but naked, cut and bruised, and frostbitten. There were parents who had lost their children, children with the loss of parents. Many, in fact, were perfectly insensible. The number got on board the Nicaragua was 129 passengers and seamen. The greater part of these was frostbitten, so they were saved by this ship. 50 to 60 were crushed to death between the ice or frozen to death. They arrived in Quebec on May 14, 1849. The fate of the two men who took the lifeboat unknown. They were never seen again. Now, the October gale that slams into the St. John. And the great thing about this electronic age, the internet makes a lot of promises that it doesn't deliver on. But as a researcher, I can go into something called Google Books now and find and more and more added every day. Find out about storms that, unless I happen to get lucky by going down to Arlington, Virginia, looking in the right box at the right time to find the right newspaper, I would never get this information. Well, a gentleman approached me. He found out about what my mission was, to find out about the October gale of 1849 and how it impacted the St. John. And a guy by the name of Rodney, so I want to thank him. He said that it came out of the tropics, this gale of October gale of 1849, and was reported to be roaring through the shipping lanes in the middle Atlantic on Friday, October 5th, 1849. The rain began in New York City at 10 a.m. on Saturday, October 6th, 1849. Meanwhile, we'll get to it, the St. John is en route. It's approaching the coast of Massachusetts. The barometer dropped to 29.60 inches at 9 p.m., and the wind was blowing out of the southeast. The peak of the gale in New York was between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. and inflicted severe damage, according to the New York Tribune. By dawn, the barometer read 29.30 inches. The wind then shifted to the northeast. In the 2 days of the gale, 2.43 inches of rain were measured, and the Presbyterian Church in 29th Street collapsed. An exhibition pavilion at 8th Street and 4th Avenue, where two large dioramas by Daguerre were on display, was blown down and tore, a priceless canvas nearly 1,000 feet long and assessed at $5,000 of 1849 dollars. In fact, this is the Louis Daguerre, and this is the Boulevard du Temple, 1838. This is the first ever photograph of a person. Where's that person? Ready? More on the October gale of 1849. The wind and barometer measurements at Sag Harbor, Long Island on Sunday, October 7th, 1849. At 6 a.m. in the morning, the wind was east by north, barometer 29.14 inches. At 9 o'clock, east northeast, 29.13 inches. At 3 o'clock, north northeast, 29.11 inches. And at 6 o'clock, north, with a barometer reading of 29.35 inches, 6.5 inches of rain fell in 33 hours, and the storm center passed along the eastern tip of Long Island. At Fort Trumbull in New London, Connecticut, 6.15 inches of rain was recorded. At Providence, the heaviest part of the storm came during the early morning hours of the 7th, but the barometer did not dip to 29.09 inches until 3 o'clock. Amherst and Framingham, Mass. Reported severe damage. In Nantucket, it blew with great violence from midnight until 2, but caused little damage, according to the Nantucket Inquirer. And at Provincetown, some small fishing vessels were lost when they broke free of their moorings. Now, the rain began to fall along the New England coast at 6 o'clock on Saturday, October 6, 1849. By midnight, a violent gale was blowing from the northeast, and the rain was falling in torrents. By Sunday, October 7th, telegraph lines, trees, and chimneys were down, and sea vessels were being driven onto the land. All telegraph communication to the south of Boston ceased. In Chelsea, one of the walls to the Universalist Church was blown down, and 2 inches of snow fell in Temple, New Hampshire, which is 10 miles north of the Massachusetts border. Now, let's take a look at this brig, St. John. Displacement, 200 tons. The owner was Henry Comerford of Galway and Ballykeed House, Kilfenora. The captain was Martin Oliver of Bowermore, Galway. The crew of 9, not including the captain. And there were 110 passengers from North Clare and Connemara. The St. John left Galway, Ireland on September 5th, 1849. She made Cape Cod Light at 5 p.m. on Saturday evening, October 6, 1849, and I hearken back to my comments, it started raining heavily at 6 o'clock an hour later. They threw anchor, and the captain passed a ration of grog to his crew. He suggested to the passengers that they celebrate their last night on board the St. John. The irony. By 1 a.m. on Sunday, October 7, 1849, she stood away northward from Scituate Light, about 2.5 miles out to clear the land until light, the light of dawn. She remained there until about 4 a.m. When the dawn began to break, he tacked and she stood south-southwest, and the captain calling the weather very thick. The ship was being driven southward toward Cohasset Bay, so she came inside Minot's Ledge, where a lighthouse was inoperable and still under construction. Just to plug a lecture, in Marshfield on April 21st, I'm doing something known as the Lighthouse Storm of 1851 and the Yankee Gale. It's about the destruction of the Minot's Ledge light, the loss of 2 lightkeepers, and the storm that overtook and breached that lighthouse. If you're interested, Marshfield, April 21st. The Grampuses. The area of rocks, rocky ledges off the coast of Cohasset, called out in any maritime map or chart. Back to the construction of Minot's Ledge Light. It was completed after the wreck of the St. John. It was under construction during the voyage of the St. John. Its first lighting was January 1st, 1850. And as I mentioned, it was destroyed in the lighthouse storm of April 1851, where 2 lighthouse keepers were swept away. Just some background on Minot's Ledge Lighthouse. Scituate had been the scene of countless shipwrecks. Between 1832 and 1841, there were 40 wrecks on this and neighboring reefs. Between 1817 and 1847, it was estimated that 40 lives and $364,000 worth of property had been lost in shipwrecks in the vicinity of Minot's Ledge off of Scituate, Mass. In 1843, Inspector I.W.P. Lewis of the Lighthouse Service emphasized the great need for a lighthouse on Minot's Ledge. Captain William H. Swift recommended an iron pile lighthouse as offering less resistance to the waves than a stone tower. The ledge was barely 20 feet wide and was only exposed at low tide, being dry only 2 or 3 hours a day. So on this narrow rock, construction was begun in the spring of 1847 of a 75-foot openwork iron light structure. The men could only work on very calm days and when the tide was at its ebb. The work was conducted from a schooner which remained near the ledge unless the sea was rough, with the workmen sleeping on board. If a storm threatened, the schooner put into Scituate Harbor until it was over. Back to the voyage. It's 6:30 a.m., and after seeing the British brig Kathleen anchored near Hooksett Rock, he tries to lend assistance to her, the captain does. But he found the captain of the St. John. He found that he could not fetch up and assist the Kathleen, which was now foundering badly. So he threw over both of the St. John's anchors. And at 7 a.m., the anchors begin to drag. She begins to drift swiftly towards Grampus Ledge. Her sails are now shredded. Captain Oliver then decides to cut away the masts of the St. John. And when you cut away the masts, you have nowhere else to go. That's your last desperate attempt. Meanwhile, this event is being witnessed on the shore by residents of the Glades House. Enormous breakers repeatedly lifted up the ship and hurled her against the rocks repeatedly. The captain would later recall that these waves were mountains high. A hole was broken in the hull, and those below deck were drowned within minutes. The brig then began to break up. People now gathered on the shore and were horrified to see people being swept off the deck by the dozens and into the boiling surf. Even though the wind howled and the surf pounded the shore, witnesses swore that they could still hear the screams of the victims. This is the only accurate representation we know of the wreck of the St. John. It appeared in Harper's Weekly in October of 1849. The jolly boat was hanging by its tackle alongside until the stern rigging broke. The boat then fell into the water and was being swept away. Captain Oliver, the second mate, and two of the crewmen, which were two apprentice boys, jumped into the maelstrom to secure her. But just then, about 25 passengers jumped into the water and swamped the jolly boat. Only Captain Oliver survived as he grabbed a rope that was hanging from the quarterdeck, and he was pulled aboard by the ship's mate and nephew of the ship's owner, Henry Comerford. The longboat was then launched, and several passengers jumped into the water to reach her. None did. They all perished. People clung to the wreckage and were slammed into the barnacle-clad rocks. The captain, the first mate, a Mr. Crawford, and the remaining members of the crew, I'm counting seven because the number's off here. If I look at some of the records as to how many crew members were there, nine, were there ten, counting the captain. And only one passenger reaches the longboat. So a lifeboat, and you can see the life-saving, Brant Rock life-saving crew. This is a depiction of them in the late 19th century. A lifeboat's then launched from land towards the brig Kathleen as the life-saving crew assumed that all from the St. John were safely on board the longboat. So they're going towards the foundering Kathleen with a skeleton crew, thinking that the St. John had the skeleton crew and that all that were aboard there were safe. Terrible assumption, a tragic assumption. They could not see through the spray and howling wind and didn't realize that there were 200 people in peril. By 4 p.m. on the 7th, 27 bodies had washed ashore, 21 women, 3 men, and 3 children. Austin Kern, Catherine Flanagan, Betsy Higgins, Mary Kane, Michael Fitzpatrick, Michael Gibbon, Barbara Keneally, Mary Slatterly, Michael Redding, Honora Cullen, Honora Burke were among the saved. Patrick Sweeney of Galway perished along with his wife and 9 children. Mr. Lathrop, who sheltered survivors in his house, waded into the surf to retrieve a parcel of clothing and quickly realized that he had an infant in his arms. The infant was said to be in excellent health. The St. John was in charge by 8 a.m. 8 women and 7 men made their way to shore almost dead of exhaustion. 21 were saved, 99 were lost. Some had to have their hands pried off of the flotsam to which they were clinging. People like Mr. Holmes, a railroad conductor, lined the shore anxiously to help rescue the living and retrieve the dead. All 7 first-class passengers were lost, including 3 nieces of the ship owner, Henry Comerford. A man clung to a timber with his mouth open, skin a deep purple, and fixed teeth and bulging eyes. By nightfall, 46 bodies were recovered. From the Boston Bee, about 100 drowned men and women. They're talking about Captain Oliver from Galway. They leave September 5th. A month later, vessel strikes the Grampuses. Cohasset Central Cemetery Memorial Cross erected by the Ancient Order of Hibernians on May 30th, 1914. Has anybody here visited this? Good, good. And now I think I have time for me to shred David Thoreau. I call it an account of a pompous interloper, and I have to read through this dreadful text, but just stay with me. This is a sketch of how he appeared in 1854. And then, you wait till the comment. This is 2 years later, a daguerreotype. He was born in Concord, Mass., July 12, 1817. An author of 20 volumes, a naturalist, a transcendentalist, a tax resister, a development critic, a sage writer, and a philosopher. He was a naturalist, certainly a superstar during his time. And then it went to his head. Best known for his book, Walden, which was a reflection upon simple living in natural surroundings, and his essay, Civil Disobedient, which was an argument for individual resistance to civil government and moral opposition to an unjust state. Contributions were his writings in natural history and philosophy, where he anticipated the methods and findings of ecology and environmental history, two sources of modern-day environmentalism. A lifelong abolitionist, delivering lectures that attacked the fugitive slave law while praising the writings of Wendell Phillips and defending abolitionist John Brown, his philosophy of nonviolent resistance influenced the political thoughts and actions of such later figures as Leo Tolstoy, Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King. An anarchist. Well, he wanted to improve government, not abolish it. Quote, I ask for, not at once, no government, but at once a better government. That government is best which governs not at all, and when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which they will have. Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote, Thoreau is as ugly as sin. Long-nosed, queer-mouthed, and with uncouth and rustic, though courteous manners, corresponding very well with such an exterior. But his ugliness is of an honest and agreeable fashion, and becomes him much better than beauty. Thoreau wore a neck beard for many years, which he insisted many women found attractive. However, Louisa May Alcott reportedly mentioned to Ralph Waldo Emerson that Thoreau's facial hair will most assuredly deflect amorous advances and preserve the man's virtue in perpetuity. And I always stray. I've studied historical food fights at Harvard. That's a long story. But anyways, Thoreau's grandfather, Asa Dunbar, instigated the Great Butter Rebellion of 1766 at Harvard when he stood up and said, Our butter doth stinketh, mimicking a minister. He was suspended and it caused a student walkout and protest. Half of the class of 1766 was suspended. Some other great food riots at Harvard include the Bread and Butter Rebellion in 1805, where students were outraged over the quality of the food being served. They felt that along with tuition came a right to a decent meal if they were paying for it. The Rotten Cabbage Rebellion of 1807, upon seeing a maggot in his cabbage soup, a student stood up and walked over to the home of Harvard President Samuel Weber and presented it to him. The student demonstrations and arson followed, and several were suspended. The Great Rebellion of 1814 caused Harvard to hire a caterer for the dining hall, a cook superior to any in the United States. The irony not lost here is while people were starving in Ireland, they're throwing their food around at Harvard. Thoreau studied at Harvard 1833 to 1837. Legend states that he refused to pay the $5 fee for a Harvard diploma. Harvard College offered it to graduates who proved their physical worth by being alive 3 years after graduating and their saving, earning, or inheriting quality or condition by having $5 to give the college. His comment was, let every sheep keep its own skin, presumably a reference to the tradition of diplomas being written on vellum, a paper made from sheepskin. In April 1844, he and his friend Edward Hoare accidentally set a fire that consumed 300 acres of Walden Woods. Thoreau embarked on a two-year experiment in simple living on July 4, 1845, when he moved to a small self-built house on land owned by Emerson and in a second-growth forest around the shores of Walden Pond. The house was not in the wilderness, but at the edge of town, a mile and a half from his family home. He left the woods on September 6, 1847, staying there 2 years, 2 months, 2 days. We've all been to Walden. July 24th or July 25th, 1846, he ran into the local tax collector, Sam Staples, who asked him to pay 6 years of delinquent poll taxes. Thoreau refuses because of his opposition to the Mexican-American War and slavery, and he spent a night in jail because of his refusal. The next day, Thoreau was freed over his protests when his aunt paid his taxes. This was the driving force behind him writing Resistance to Civil Government or Civil Disobedience. Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison. He became fascinated with natural history and botany in 1851. He worked as a land surveyor. He traveled to Quebec, Cape Cod 4 times, Maine 3 times, and these landscapes inspired his excursion books. Other travels took him southwest to Philadelphia and New York City in 1854 and across the Great Lakes region in 1861, visiting Niagara Falls, Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Mackinac Island. He first contracted tuberculosis in 1835 and suffered from it sporadically over his life. In 1859, he followed a late-night excursion to count the rings of 3 tree stumps during a rainstorm. He became ill with bronchitis. I side with the man. His health declined over 3 years with brief periods of remission until he eventually became bedridden. He spent his last 3 years revising and editing his unpublished works, particularly The Maine Woods and Excursions, and begging publishers to print revised editions of A Week in Walden. His friends were alarmed at his diminished appearance and were fascinated by his tranquil acceptance of death. When his Aunt Louisa asked him in his last weeks if he had made his peace with God, he responded, "I didn't even know we had ever quarreled." Aware he was dying, Thoreau's last words were, "Now comes good sailing," followed by 2 lone words, "Moose and Indian." He died on May 6, 1862, at age 44. Emerson gave the eulogy. He's buried in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Concord, Mass. So now I'm going to read you. Bear with me. I just have to read what this man says about the St. John. He's going down there looking for dead bodies to kick, okay? That's what he's looking for. And he's really upset. He wants to write a story about corpses and bloated faces, and he doesn't see corpse, and he's kind of upset. So just take that into context. He's looking for a story, and he wants a body to kick. We left Concord, Massachusetts on Tuesday, October 9th, 1849. On reaching Boston, we found that the Provincetown steamer, which should have got in the day before, had not yet arrived on account of a violent storm. We're talking about the October gale. And as we noticed in the streets, a handbill headed "Death, 145 lives lost to Cohasset." We decided to go by way of Cohasset. We found many Irish in the cars, going to identify bodies and to sympathize with the survivors, and also to attend the funeral, which was to take place in the afternoon. And when we arrived at Cohasset, it appeared that nearly all passengers were bound for the beach, which was about a mile distant, and many other persons were flocking in from the neighboring country. There were several hundreds of them streaming off over Cohasset Common in that direction, some on foot and some in wagons, and among them were some sportsmen in their hunting jackets with their guns and game bags and dogs. As we passed the graveyard, we saw a large hole, like a cellar, freshly dug there, and just before reaching the shore, by a pleasantly winding and rocky road, we met several hay riggings and farm wagons coming away toward the meeting house, each loaded with 3 large rough deal boxes. We did not need to ask what was in them. These are coffins. The owners of the wagons were made the undertakers. Many horses and carriages were fastened to the fences near the shore, and for a mile or more up and down the beach was covered with people looking out for bodies and examining the fragments of the wreck. It was now Tuesday morning, and the sea was still breaking violently on the rocks. There were 18 or 20 of the same large boxes that I've mentioned, lying on a green hillside, a few rods from the water and surrounded by a crowd. The bodies, which had been recovered, 27 or 28 in all, had been collected there. Some were rapidly nailing down the lids, others were carting the boxes away, and others were lifting the lids, which were yet loose, and peeping under the cloths, for each body, with such rags as still adhered to it, was covered loosely with a white sheet. I witnessed no signs of grief, but there was a sober dispatch of business which was affecting. One man was seeking to identify a particular body, and one undertaker or carpenter was calling to another to know in what box a certain child was put. I saw many marble feet and matted heads as the cloths were raised, and one livid, swollen, and mangled body of a drowned girl who probably had intended to go out to service in some American family, to which some rags still adhered with a string half concealed by the flesh about its swollen neck. Sometimes there were 2 or more children or a parent and child in the same box, and on the lid would perhaps be written with red chalk, "Bridget such a one and sister's child, etc." I have since heard from one who lives by this beach that a woman who had come over before but had left her infant behind for her sister to bring came and looked into these boxes and saw in one, probably the same whose superscription I've quoted, her child in her sister's arms, as if the sister had meant to be found thus, and within 3 days after, the mother died from the effect of that sight. She sees her sister holding her baby. In the first cove were strewn what seemed the fragments of a vessel in small pieces mixed with sand and seaweed and great quantities of feathers, but it looked so old and rusty that I at first took it to be some old wreck which had lain there many years. I asked a sailor if that was the St. John. He said, yes, it was. I asked him where she struck. He pointed to a rock in front of us, a mile from the shore, called the Grampus Rock, and added, you can see a part of her now sticking up. It looks like a small boat. I saw it. It was thought to be held by the chain cables and the anchors. I asked if the bodies which I saw were all that were drowned. Not a quarter of them, he said. Where are the rest? Most of them right underneath that piece, you see. About a mile south, we could see, rising above the rocks, the masts of the British brig, which the St. John had endeavored to follow. Kathleen, we're talking about. Which had slipped her cables and, by good luck, run into the mouth of Cohasset Harbor. How ironic is that? The Kathleen survives. A little further along the shore, we saw a man's clothes on a rock, further a woman's scarf, a gown, a straw bonnet, the brig's caboose, and one of her masts, high and dry, broken into several pieces. In another rocky cove, several rods from the water and behind rocks 20 feet high, lay a part of one side of the vessel, still hanging together. It was perhaps 40 feet long by 14 wide. I was even more surprised at the power of the waves exhibited on the shattered fragment than I had been at the sight of the smaller fragments before. The largest timbers and iron braces were broken superfluously, and I saw that no material could withstand the power of the waves. That iron must go to pieces in such a case, and an iron vessel would be cracked up like an eggshell on the rocks. Some of these timbers, however, were so rotten that I could almost thrust my umbrella through them. And finally, they told us that some were saved on this piece and also showed where the sea had heaved into this cove, in which was now dry. When I saw where it had come in and in what condition, I wondered that any had been saved on it. A little further on, a crowd of men was collected around the mate of the St. John, who was telling his story. He was a slim-looking youth who spoke of the captain as the master and seemed a little excited. He was saying that when they jumped into the boat, she filled and the vessel, lurching, the weight of the water in the boat caused the painter to break, so they were separated. On the whole, it was not so impressive a scene as I might have expected. If I had found one body cast upon the beach in some lonely place, it would have affected me more. I sympathized rather with the winds and waves, as if to toss and mangle these poor human bodies was the order of the day. So he's not sympathizing, he's sympathizing with the wind and the waves, not the bodies. If this was the law of nature, why waste any time in our pity? If the last day were come, we should not think so much about the separation of friends or the blighted prospects of individuals. That's a pun there. I saw that corpses might be multiplied as on the field of battle till they no longer affected us in any degree as exceptions to the common lot of humanity. Many days after this, something white was seen floating on the water by one who was sauntering on the beach. It was approached in a boat and found to be the body of a woman, which had risen in an upright position, whose white cap was blown back with the wind. Why care for these dead bodies? They really have no friends but the worms or fishes. Their owners were coming to the New World, as Columbus and the Pilgrims did. They were within a mile of its shores, but before they could reach it, they emigrated to a newer world than ever Columbus ever dreamed of. Yet one of whose existence was, we believe, there is far more universal and convincing evidence, though it has not yet been discovered by science, than Columbus had of this. And again, that's it. So that's my talk on the St. John. I don't know if you wanted me to talk about to show you some quick shipwrecks at the South Shore, 5 minutes. Do you guys want to see that?
Sure.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions before we go on the St. John? Any comments? Yes. I don't have the answer for that. I'm going to say normal longboat would be 12. The jolly boat, probably 8. But people jumped in and swamped it. So, Jack, me in here? No? Okay.
The jolly boat
lifeboat?
Right, a version of it, a smaller, shorter lifeboat than a longboat. And of course, they never had enough for all the people on board, and these famine ships were packed. They were packed in, they were overcrowded. But and they were victims of the gale. If they had gotten in, if they had made time a day earlier, there would be no wreck of the St. John. But they literally, the gale came up the coast and smashed them. And the people watching on the shore couldn't do anything. Helpless. The Sparrowhawk is the first shipwreck in the history of the United States. It's estimated that well over 2,000 shipwrecks are off the Massachusetts coast. This was built in 1623, a bark, 29-foot keel. It had 25 immigrants, and it was lost December 1626 while heading to Virginia. It was unearthed in the storm in 1862, and the remnants are on display at Pilgrim Hall since 1889. The location was Nauset Harbor, Orleans, and all hands were saved. It's the first recorded shipwreck on the east coast of the United States. Buried by tides over years, Indians used the masts for firewood. Another ship, 1852, lost off the coast of Humrock. This is just the south shore where I grew up summers, called the Marcus. The Minerva went down carrying wine, sugar, and iron. It was lost in 1780, 1787, or 1795, depending upon who you listen to on Wrexham Beach. I tend to think that it happened in 1787. The Forest Queen was a ship that went down due to a nor'easter of February 29th, 1853, off the coast of Scituate, Second Cliff, Scituate. It was a 158-foot full-rig cargo ship. The Amanda went down in 1864 at Brant Rock Cove. The Agnes R. Bacon was lost in the blizzard of 1888. People don't understand that that was a furious blizzard that raked New York and also slammed into Boston. Beatles Rock and Wrexham, it was lost. A ship called the Chattanooga, built, lost in 1888, same storm, at Hewitt's Point, Ocean Bluff. These are actual photographs. The Columbia was lost in November 27, 1898, something known as the Portland Gale in Scituate. The Myrtis H. Perry was also lost during the Portland Gale. It was grounded 200 yards off of Wrexham Beach. The remnants came ashore during the blizzard of 1978. The Delaware was lost also to the Portland Gale, November 27, 1898. The Portland Gale basically made Humrock an island. It changed the direction of the North River in Marshfield. The Frank A. Palmer and the Louise B. Crary collided, and they went down just like that. The collision took place on December 17, 1902. 11 people were lost. The Palmer was carrying coal. The Windsor was a ship that was 203 feet in length. It had coal as well. It was lost in a blizzard of December of 1946. It's now a remarkable marine habitat right off the coast of Marshfield. The Kenwood was lost in the gale of February 4th, 1926. It landed on the rocks on the north side of Cedar Point, Scituate. The Nancy, this was lost nor'easter February 27, 1970s. 1927, but for years it sat on the beach in Nantasket Beach, and it remained as a tourist attraction for many, many years until the hull was burned to the keel. The Fairfax Pinthas disaster, what is it, Buoy 58, the disaster of Buoy 58. This happened in 1930 in the fog on June 10th. 50 men were lost from both ships. It's the collision happened 6 miles east of Fourth Cliff, Scituate. The Fairfax did not sink, the Pinthas did. Southland was lost December 2nd, 1930. It was burned and scuttled off of Scituate. Some other ships, the Henry Endicott, was lost on September 18th, 1939, foundered while under tow in heavy seas. This is off Manomet Point in Plymouth. I'm basically taking shipwrecks in the general vicinity of the St. John here. The Mars was lost on September 13, 1942, when it collided with a tanker called Bidwell, east of Manomet Point, Plymouth, in 120 feet of water. The Etrusco, anybody ever hear about this one? In Scituate, lost in the nor'easter of March 16, 1956, at Cedar Point Lighthouse. It remained aground for several months and then hauled off and repaired and put back into service. The Sankaty Head, lost on October 12, 1967. The trawl door pierced the hull. It was off Manomet Point, Plymouth. And that's all I have for you tonight. You've been a great audience. Thank you so much. Any other final questions?
Yes. There, clinging to the wreckage, and the rescue team coming out of Cohasset, which I think was headed by Mr. Lathrop, whose daughter left an account of these events as she was witnessing them ashore, indicated that they probably could have saved some of those passengers had they been told that there were still people there, and instead they went.
Interesting. I harken back to my first slide about somebody who knows more about the incident. Obviously, that's a piece of data I never had. So, had they been told, and they weren't, and maybe can we attribute that to shock? Can we attribute that to the wind and the rain howling, or selfishness?
I don't know, but they seem to think, and the statement that he gave to the local town officials was that there was no effort to signal them. There might be people still there, and that boat landed at the Glades across from Cohasset Harbor. It didn't go into the harbor. The Glades is the outer peninsula, just kind of directly south of Minas Light. But the other interesting thing is, and you mentioned the dispute about how many people were lost in the account. Some of the survivors indicated that captain only took a listing the night before of 100 passengers. And once he got to 100, he drew a line and then wrote other passengers' names, in another piece of paper. And why that might be significant is that it could be that he was overloading the ship in relation to the new navigation laws that had just been passed. There's all kinds of questions about his conduct there.
Captain Oliver.
Yeah. And after the funeral, he went to Boston and was never heard of again. I don't know if he's ever showed up in Galway again. I've tried to, track that down, but haven't had much luck yet.
Well, you're on the right trail. I mean, you've just given me 10 data points that I was not aware of. So Oliver never went back to Ireland. I always thought that he went to New Hampshire.
He never did.
Portsmouth is what I was
told. Cumberford joined who was a doctor of some kind, joined the American Navy.
The owner of the ship you're talking about, Henry, or are you talking about the first mate, the son of?
No, Oliver was captain.
Correct.
And the first mate was, I think, related to
yes.
the man he listed
That's
as,
correct.
As the owner.
That's correct.
But as far as I know, he didn't go back to Ireland either.
Mm.
And there is a dispute as to who actually owned the ship and who built it. Oliver wasn't the regular captain, supposedly. He was filling in on that voyage for a man who was regularly the captain, but stayed back in Galway because his wife was ill, so he was going to skip that voyage. But you wonder whether, if it had been a different captain.
Right. Yeah, I mean, timing was so critical here.
1849 is when these new laws came into effect, but I'm not sure the date. So, that's an interesting point to pursue in terms of the people that were lost.
Yeah, if he had gotten in a day earlier, I mean, you saw how he breaks southeast. He was trying to drag anchor, and he recognized the storm. The weather being very thick, I think, was the quote that he used. So he tried to make a run for it. But when you hack off your mast, you're all done.
Well, that part of the coast, if you look at that, he was inside Minas Light, and he was facing the northeast, and the
there's no way she can get back up into the channel. I mean, it's just impossible for God.
Yeah, yeah. Can I ask you, what books have you, are there any books that you can suggest, or where have you been going through old newspapers? This is years of research, isn't it? I mean,
she booked the Irish Patriot, and so
also the Irish Kid.
She knew she had a fly about Fort Byron. At the Moss,
the Irish Moth Museum.
Oh, okay, I didn't know, I've been using mostly Cohasset.
Yeah, well, the Irish Moth Museum also have a museum of life saving where the first lifeguard started in America, and they have a lot of information about the longboats that were used for survivors and stuff.
Right.
Have you ever held a fragment of the ship in your hand?
I've seen the captain's desk,
okay,
which is in the Cohasset Historical Museum. And you know, there's an interesting story about that that's you know, recorded in their papers too. The desk would have been a small, like, writing box, and evidently this was washed ashore with a wreckage, and as people were down on the beach, somebody was seen to pick up this box, a man was seen to pick up this box, and carry it away and stick it under some bushes. And later, this particular person was found to have a lifestyle that was much superior to what he had been used to.
Some plunder.
And the theory is that probably in that box was the ship's money, which he decided to keep.
Wow.
And this box had come down through a number of Cohasset families and then given to the Historical Museum, I think, in the 1930s or something. And this woman gives this story. Lucy Tree is her name. But there's all kinds of fascinating details to follow in terms of this wreck.
Well, I'd love to talk with you more on this. I mean, you've got some nice little pearls of wisdom there and some insight that I hadn't been aware of. And it is a tragedy, and like you said, the onus can't fall on the life-saving crew if they try to interact with the captain and they weren't told that there were other people in the boiling surf, and so naturally they'd head off to the Kathleen.
Yeah, right.
They're trying to help.
And they said that, you know, had they known, they you know, would have made an effort, but it would have been successful or not. It's another story. Could I just make another comment about your earlier presentation in terms of the outbreak of the famine? I think you have to recognize that the government that was in power when the famine broke out, and the Prime Minister was Sir Robert Peel, that he did himself recognize the severity of what was happening and tried to do as much as he could in terms of the time, in terms of what economic philosophy would have allowed. I mean, the corn laws were abolished. He secretly ordered the Indian corn, et cetera, et cetera. And then there certainly were efforts of public works. Now, we can certainly be critical in this day and age that it wasn't enough in Trevelyan. I agree with you, though. Trevelyan was a man of immense responsibility for exacerbating the crisis. But I think you're kind of going a little bit too far to refer to this as genocide. The debates that took place, I know it's a debate.
Oh, a democide.
Yeah, sure. Well, so, you know, I think you need to try to nuance a little bit the idea that, you know, the government did try to do something. It was limited. It was insufficient.
Mm.
But, I mean, we're facing the same thing today, aren't we?
Yeah, but I think it was minimal. There could have been more done.
Yeah.
And I think, and again, I hearken back to this revisionism that's taking place. And no offense, but you're a victim of that. What you're just saying here is that it wasn't as bad as people put it out to
be. I'm not saying that the death and destruction, no, absolutely not. But I think one has to acknowledge that government, they didn't do enough, obviously.
Mm. They did very little.
They
did very little.
Well, you know, and some of the people who were evicted by fellow Irish people, too.
Right.
So.
But it's...
But being paid by the English.
Yes.
Do you know, have you heard that the Irish government is officially recognizing Angota War for what it was? May 17th of this year, there will be a commemorative service in Skibbereen and on Gros Eel in the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, recognizing the Angota War, the Great Hunger, and they call them the martyrs. And I would be glad to give you the rating on it because it's going to happen this year. I informed my Division 14, I'm a member of Division 14.
Sure. 160 years, yeah.
Recognized as a commemorative day, and they have asked Irish organizations to recognize it for such. So the government has now said what it was, the murder of over almost 2 million people.
Hmm. Now, he said that. I didn't.
No, I'll show that in writing.
Sure, sure. Now,
yes. They call it
Angota
War.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's officially recognized for what it is now by the Irish government.
So you're going to give this talk in Marshall at the library?
Yeah, at the library, April 21st, the lighthouse storm, just about minus left. But just closing on this, the Peel,
mm-hmm.
Sure, he made an effort, but he was hamstrung. He was tied up.
Out of office.
Right. But well, it cost him his position.
It cost him his,
right.
His
so position. If you look at the others, and I guess we're all creatures of the human condition, everybody else stood back. And that rippled down. And again, you saw, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Queen Victoria. I call her England's Bill Clinton. She just got lucky. Things were going well for her, and she just happened to be riding that wave. But I disagree with you that England tried. I'm sorry. I can't agree with you. And are you Irish?
Yes.
Okay. No, I just think that there is this thing that there's this thing that emerged. It first emerged in the early 20th century. It's revisionism. And that both sides are guilty of it, where one will drum up and say the catastrophe was worse than it was, and then the other will say it wasn't that bad and there's more to blame.
I'm not saying it wasn't bad.
Yeah. No, but I know what you're saying, that they do drum up and you can't say genocide, I agree. I think that they stay within the laws, and a lot of people did turn their back on their brother, Irish brothers and sisters. There's no doubt. There's no doubt. And they did want, and said, why would you want a peasant when you could have cattle grazing there? That much easier, higher profit. They couldn't wait to get them out. But the other thing that you have to consider is what happened in Scotland during that time, too, is that all...
Yeah, differences in treatment of Ireland and Scotland happened later in the century, too. Famines of 1870s, 1880s. People who were opposed to giving certain relief in Ireland were helping out the crofters in Scotland or lowering their rents when they weren't doing the same thing in
Ireland. That's because she had her summer home in Scotland. It was all under sovereign rule, and she lived in Scotland during the summer.
Yeah, right, Balmoral.
Right. And you're right, there's a lot of contradictions this year. And it's frightening to think, and people forget in this, I call this period that we're in right now with this recession, the great humbling, where abundance on demand, that's over, where people can reach. And if famine, you know, people talk about the pandemic, but what about famine if our cereal crops fail? I mean, from the rest of the world's perspective, our most valuable asset in America are our fields of grain. Can you imagine if a blight or some sort of fungus or ecoterrorism happened and those were wiped out, or the rice crops in Asia? It's very frightening to think that the food can dwindle down. And famine can happen again. We haven't seen the last of famine. And I think
that... Look at
Africa
today on the verge of famine.
Frightening. Did you have a question? I'm sorry.
I did. This was fascinating.
I enjoy your report, by the way. You've added some fascinating tips. Thank you so much.
I forget what date you said the marker was put up by the Hibernians.
1914.
So that was less than 100 years or so. But my question, and I'm not a Hibernian, what was the driver to put that up, to erect that? I might be before the end of the night. but what was the driver for them to erect the monument?
I bet you it was one of the brothers came up with the idea. It was, 55 years later? Why don't we honor these people and put up some sort of cross there? And it was a good thing to do. Yes.
Well, it's also in the context of how far the Irish had come in Boston, you know, politically. You had Honey Fitz as mayor.
Oh, sure, yeah.
David I. Walsh.
Good point.
First Catholic governor.
Good point.
Gave the big speech. You know, the Irish had arrived.
Yes.
So yeah. That obviously was a motivation. But if anybody here knows anything about where records might be of the Hibernians, because I've contacted the national people.
Boston College. They're over all the records.
They have of the AOH?
Well, the ladies, anyway. I don't know.
Burns Library.
Yeah.
All
Hibernian.
And they have a list of the people who subscribe money and that kind of thing.
Records like that wouldn't count. Because basically what happened back in the early divisions, the records were passed from man to man to keep the records. There was no central depository.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, you might be lucky to find, sometimes what happens, we'll hear someone, their grandfather passes away, and they're up in the attic going through stuff, and they find something that belongs to the AOH. And there was a lot of divisions that are now defunct. There's only 18 men's divisions in Massachusetts now. Mm-hmm. Back in the heyday, there was thousands.
Right.
And there were you know, 50, 60, 100 in Boston. And those records would just pass from one man to another, and they were lost. Every once in a while, like I was saying, somebody finds these records and they contact one of the guys on the state boards or their local divisions, and we try to take the records and see what we can do with them, you know?
Is the AOH also with
the
just the ladies?
I believe the Mets are down in Philadelphia somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
The ladies' names are inscribed in the stone. Have you been to Ireland? Doing research on this?
Some research.
Yeah.
Finished it yet.
You've obviously done all the research in the Cohasset Historical Society, the Mossing Museum.
Not the Mossing Museum. I didn't know they had anything.
What about the Mass Historical Society?
I haven't found anything specific there yet.
Oh, you've gone there?
I've been in there. I'm halfway through looking at stuff.
Okay. What about NARA?
I was told there's a new book coming out on the Prince St. John. I forget who told me, but there is a book supposed to be, a new book that's supposed to be coming out soon about the Great St. John. I don't know anything about the author or anything. I'll get back to the person who told me and see if I can find something out about it.
Well, I'll give you my address.
Yeah, I think you should write a book on this.
Well, I'm getting a paper on this ready for June.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
If I gave you my card, would you consider... give me the opportunity to read it, because this is just, I have not rolled up the sleeves and gone to Ireland and done the investigation. One thing I wanted to ask you is about the families that ended up, that survived this wreck. Did they, where they settled? One of my lectures.
It's my understanding that all but one of the survivors returned to Ireland. And one woman who was a single woman, I think this was she married a man from Cohasset whose name was St. John.
Wow.
Who was a widower. They didn't have any children, but he had children by his first wife, and some of those people are still living in Cohasset in the greater Boston area.
Wow.
And that's also in my...
Your agenda.
Sure. That's great. Keep going. We all wish you the best success. And you know, as a researcher, that serendipity, when you at least look, you're looking for something, you think you're not going to find it there, some sort of article pops out or a piece of data. It's amazing.
I have one more question.
Yes.
I'm sorry. And forgive me if I missed this, but are there records on the strength of the storm and that stuff? And
yes.
If so, how does that storm compare with, you know, the only storm I have in my memory of being, you know, that big, which would be the perfect storm in the 90s?
It's a right gale. Nothing like the perfect storm. Okay. Perfect storm was a one-eyed monster. We didn't suffer the perfect storm. It happened at sea.
Right.
It's a nor'easter.
Okay.
It's a big blow. And I've been studying historical weather from the period of 1849 through 1852, and that period in New England was unprecedented. It's the end of what was known as the mini ice age. There was some cooler weather. Some people can say it culminated with the year without a summer, which was 1816, from a volcano known as Tambora in the Philippines that exploded, causing the snow on June 7th, 1816 in Boston Common. And that was a cooling period, but there was an unprecedented weather beginning with the October gale of 1849. There was a tornado that went down Route 20 and Route 60 called the Middlesex Tornado on August 22nd, 1851. The Yankee gale, which is a very impressive, which no pun intended, blew this away. And then the lighthouse storm. It's a fierce storm.
Yeah.
It's a once-a-decade storm, and in that period, we had five once-a-decade storms. And I just finished a couple of rounds of lectures on the Great Hurricane in 1938, and I look around, there's nobody that was around during that time, so unfortunately.
You're going to have your eyes checked.
So, but if there were people that were around in 1938, they can understand the ferocity of a hurricane, and you're going to have idiots with bottles of beer going down to the beach during a hurricane. Right. And the devastation that would happen to Boston, and they normally track, they cut a path right across Long Island, right up the Connecticut River Valley. If you look at what Carol, Donna, the Atlantic Hurricane of 44, Hurricane of 38, Great September Gale of 1815, the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635, they follow the same pattern. So I always didn't like this National Hurricane doing Nostradamus and saying you're going to have X amount of hurricanes. Stop it. They've never been right. They should have stopped that practice years ago. And now no one's going to listen to them. So, and we're in a very dormant period. Very dormant period over the last seven, eight, this whole decade for bad weather here. I know, I'm sorry. This portion of the year we call sprinter, right? Spring, winter. I'm sorry. So I guess, does anybody else have any other closing comments? No, half hour.
Getting back to the AOH and the cross, for a number of years now, the AOH still holds a memorial mass and a wreath laying at the cross the first Sunday in October. The mass is usually a 1 or a 2 o'clock in the afternoon mass at St. Anthony's in Cohasset.
Really?
And they have a church hall there. We go out and have a little program, and then we travel down to the cross for appropriate remarks and a wreath lay. And I believe back in 1997, we had a major, it was a major anniversary, it was 150th year, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we had descendants of the lost come over from Lettermullen and Corot in Galway. And at the time, Cardinal Law was the cardinal here. He said the mass. And we went, we processioned, but we had pipers. We went from St. Anthony's down to the cross, and it was quite an impressive. It was pouring rain that day, but it was impressive to have relatives these people come over from Ireland and participate in this particular event, commemorating the loss of their beloved on Grandpa's Ledge there.
Do you go to that mass every year?
Yes, usually.
Can I give you my card? You give me a shout.
I will.
Okay. And yes, Leo.
Just let's see. This is Dick Thompson. He's the
state
president.
Hey, Dick. Dick, pleasure. Thank you, Dick.
Also past.
That's a bunch of McCord and gets him a cup of coffee.
also past president, 14. But what Dick is working on right now, he's the national chairman for the committee that is going to do a commemorative up in Canada at the Gros Eel Monument that we put up there. And this year we'll be commemorating the 100th year of that cross. And we from Division 14 and throughout, and a few other members through the country, through the United States, are going up to Quebec to go to that dedication.
Oh, great. That's great.
That's going to be in May.
Great.
No, August.
August 15th, Lady Day.
Yes, sir.
Very quickly, I have a picture of the, I've been to Ireland and let alone, and I have a picture of the little cross that's there. If you'd like, I'll make a copy of it.
Oh, I'd love to, yeah, certainly. Certainly, absolutely.
Have you been to the church there also?
No, I haven't been to the church. I've been to the house that was built by one of the survivors.
Are you from Mushroom?
There's a little
summer there.
Where
Green Harbor.
Anyway, there's a plaque there.
Well, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Hibernians. God bless you.